not located totally within one, other discussions are beginning to identify these horrible phenomena of transfer pricing, because it can generate lots of resources for society. And the other issue is the whole issue of coordination of industrial policy across departments, intra-governmental coordination of these policy instruments and actions. I don't understand why IDC is in economic development. I don't understand why PIC can't be given a concrete mandate for transformational investments, to say that the issue I raise is that we'll only invest in corporations that are going to beneficiate and industrialize locally. PIC has got a stake in Sasol, and Sasol is engaged in illegal activities and is blatantly attempting to escape accountability. The PIC should have the foresight and determination to say that as a stakeholder or as a shareholder in some of the corporations, there should be local beneficiation and industrialization of these resources. But there are lots of issues we can identify in terms of the loopholes that exist in the entire economic cluster and sector. And we need honest, it's not a partisan political issue, because when we raise it in the portfolio committees, in the budget rules, the politicians from Pretoria say, no, cabinet is the coordinating structure. How can you reduce any important issue that requires detail to this level to say cabinet is going to coordinate the natural policy? It needs decisive political decision to collapse some of the ministries and give a proper direction in terms of what should happen. Because majority of the time the law is being flouted and no one is doing anything about it. So there must be some sense of seriousness in terms of how we deal with this issue. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Shivambu. Honourable Elvis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just basically two questions. One to Dr. Jordan. He has an interesting proposal. One needs to study it further, but what are the risks involved? I want to ask him whether he's considered the unintended consequences and risks involved in such a plan. It's quite a bold plan. And then also, one of the risks might be that you will be scaring off local and international investors. What will be the operational plan? If that happens, will you ask pension funds to invest? Will you start own local companies by using our own savings in some way? And regarding the RR tax at 50%, is that an arbitrary number? Does it have any logical consequence or reasoning behind it? And then the Competition Commission have rightly said that they have a delayed effect due to the long process of going through the legal process in terms of their own constituent law. And if one creates regulation or changes in the Act for a new, completely new bill, have they considered the constitutionality thereof in terms of putting basically disallowing IPP pricing to take place within a South African sector? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honourable Elders. Honourable Matali.
Thanks, Chair. To commend the committee for this kind of interaction is very, very helpful. I think it's important to acknowledge where we come from, and that currently what we are faced with as a country is the leaders of our party. And for us to bring about change that will have impact on the lives of our people, we need to do things differently. And I think the presentation has pointed in that direction. And of course, the need for a radical change in terms of how we approach issues is the right decision. And I think our development institution like your IDC can play a critical role in that regard, because we cannot continue to act with a state that is not interventionist in approach. And clearly, from what both Samda and Dr. Jordan and Professor have presented here, it says you need a direct intervention by the state, otherwise it will continue to be business as usual. And we can't at this moment allow that to continue to happen. The legislation and pronouncement have been made. It's more for us to see how those legislations are implemented. For instance, if you look within the mining sector, clear decisions were taken that you need black people and Africans in particular becoming part of the ownership, even though we are still talking at 26%. But if you look at implementation, we are way behind that. And in terms of our own objective as the ruling party to transform the South African economy, we've been saying the liberation, or that South Africa has arrived at an unracial state, it will be reflected by the role that the most oppressed, which are the Africans, in terms of the role that they play in their position within the economy. And I think that 20 years on, we are still wanting as far as that is concerned. And I think the inputs here to us as policymakers, they are just a wake-up call that we must go back and do things differently. Thanks, Chair.
No, thank you very much. Now, is there any outstanding hand here from the committee? No. We're going to ask the presenters here just very succinctly to give their response. Very sharp. All right? So, take it. Who's going to start the responses first? All right, let me start directing then, if you're too shy to put your hand up. There were some questions for the Competition Commission. There were some questions from mining. There was also some questions for yourself, Ms. Kadeli, among others. Now, let's start. IDC was there. Who's starting? Right, Ms. Kadeli.
In terms of the question about the historically disadvantaged members in South Africa that are also contributing towards that, if you look at those 49 listed companies, you find that a lot of the BE companies do not have unencumbered net value. But the unencumbered net value means they don't have ownership vesting in their hands. It's like when you own a car or a house, and you're staying and sleeping in the house, and behaving as if you own the house, you drive the car, you tell your child, you tell your country, your friends, and everybody, I bought the car is mine. But to the extent that you haven't paid up the car 100%, the car is still going to be owned by the bank. So the same thing is with the mines. The mines, black people say they own, but when you look at the payment profile, they have not owed, they have not paid 100%. And because they don't have unencumbered net value, they don't have the share certificates in their hands. The share certificates are still in the hands of the banks, or in the hands of the vendor funder, or whoever the financier is. So that's, for as long as the share certificates are somewhere else, you don't own the shares. So there's very, very limited that you can do in as a black person, or an historically disadvantaged South African, whether you're a white woman, or a black woman, or a black, or HDSA. There's not much you can do. So the major, what they would do, the person who is having more than 74%, 76%, 26%, would then be the one that's going to have management fees and marketing fees. And through the management fees and marketing fees, the circle continues. Profits are not being paid, you don't get the money, you can't pay your shares, you've never owned the mine. 2014, the ownership is still vested in the hands of a few. Now there are four companies that at least could or would be locally owned with local black ownership. But the difference with those companies is that with the two or three well-documented nations, the primary listing is here. ARM, the primary listing is in South Africa. AngloGold Ashanti, the primary listing is in South Africa. And Impala, the primary listing is in South Africa. So you find that the Reserve Bank has rules and regulations that manage and control the way you're going to do things. Now, if you're listed in an offshore haven, you don't have a Reserve Bank of South Africa that can control what you're doing. So you find that many of these companies where the primary listing is in South Africa are maybe not as guilty of what we're speaking about to the extent that the foreign companies are, because the Reserve Bank and the South African Act cannot legislate in a tax haven which is foreign owned. So that's where it comes from. And in terms of anything else beyond that, I'm very happy that you spoke about the state. It all orbits around the legislation, but who is the legislator? The state. Who has to make sure that these rules and regulations are being adhered to? The Department of Trade and Industry and Department of Mineral and Energy. The DDGs, the officials, the portfolio committee members, and the rulers. If you look at the Act, there are lots of clauses in the law that gives you the power to enforce compliance. And 2014 is the year that compliance has to prevail. And I've got Neil Barkis, who can then answer a lot of other things. He's a mineral economist, so if you need him to answer any other things, he can help.
He will add a little bit later. Mr. Bonacchelli from the Competition Commission.
Thank you, Chair. Let me start with this, go back to this coordination question that's been asked. I guess what we are saying here is we have tabulated all of these market abuses, which point very squarely to the private sector. But what we're saying also is that the public sector has not been doing its job, because a lot of these reflect regulatory failure. A lot of these reflect failure to intervene decisively. And the problem is, we're sitting here, it's 20 years on. And really, I think that there are two questions to be posed to deal with this matter decisively. The one is the availability within the public sector of a capable skills that are able to deal with this type of issues that we're talking about. I mean, the politicians can talk and talk. Ultimately, the public sector works through the administration. I think that's one of the first questions that have to be addressed, the capacity of the state. Of course, there is a related matter of the political will, which I think you have considerable influence over, but certainly I think that if we review what has been happening in the past 20 years, you find that there are departments that are more willing to do things, and there are departments that are putting brakes. So that's the coordination question. I leave it to you. The IBP and constitutional provisions. I think what we're saying is that IPP is a practice, not a constitutional issue. It's a conduct that firms decide to engage in. And in fact, a lot of this thing can happen or not happen depending on how the state responds to it. There are many examples of how the states have done this. I mean, China is a good example, actually, because you've had companies that are supported by the state there getting cheap financing, and in return China has put export taxes so that those companies first and foremost beneficiate in China, and export taxes only get lifted when the Chinese demand for those products has been serviced. So this is in a sense a strategic question. This is not just whether there is a law or no law. I think that there are enough rules to deal with this. What is needed is really people to think of creative ways. And we've made examples of how, for example, you could use mining legislation to achieve this. You don't even need an amendment. I mean, we've been talking about amendments a lot. The current mining legislation allows government to have conditions on beneficiations, and I agree that maybe we need to specifically talk about industrialization, because that's where jobs are going to come from. The one proposal we have, of course, is that we're not happy with the processes that the Competition Commission, the timeline that it takes, and we are talking to the relevant department, economic development, about possible amendments. We've got to look whether there are not too many appeal stages. We've got to look at whether institutionally, the way we are structured, we are able to respond to these things more decisively. But really, the message has to come from the state. The private sector takes cue from the state. And I think that's the message that we've been saying today.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bonichelli. Professor Roberts?
Thank you. I don't think there are any questions directed at me.
Dr. Jordan?
Thank you. The question was the one around the IDC. Clearly you've got to get into the first phase of energy intensive before you can get into the next phase of fabrication. So if we didn't have the IDC's investment in Columbus Stainless Steel, you can't get into stainless steel fabrication where the jobs are. The more pertinent question is that when the IDC put that list up, they nearly all monopoly prices. So that's good for the IDC's balance sheet. Good profits, but disastrous for the national balance sheet. That is the pertinent question. To what extent could the IDC, for instance, take product instead of dividends, right, like it's done in many ferrochrome sources, and then use that product to stimulate downstream and take your profit there and not... Don't take your profit at Columbus. Don't take your profit at Saldana. Take your profit from the downstream fabrication, and then you get both profit and jobs. At the moment, you only get profit. So, in general, IDC has been one of the worst abusers of IPP, including their own, like Foscor was doing it, and they've now stopped because of the Competition Commission. But that is the critical question. Is the IDC helping us combat this abuse of pricing? The second question was at this juncture between the NGP and the NDP, specifically around the state mining company. Well, a resource rent tax, because it's after a reasonable return, can be equated to equity. They're kind of interchangeable. Equity would give you if you have 50% of equity, you'd get 50% of dividends, right? If you had a resource rent tax, it would give you 50% of all free cash after a reasonable return. So they're very, very close. And I don't think there's that big a disjuncture other than the National Development Plan doesn't go into that kind of detail that the NGP actually spells it out. Then was it Mr. Albert on the risks of the plan? Yeah. Would it scare off investors? Well, the critical issue is this. On each of the things we've recommended, like a local content, like a RDI spend, etc., if that's set at what the company is already doing, for instance, the chart is 5% HRD spend, that is what responsible companies are already doing. So you only then hit in the rats and mice, the companies that actually aren't investing in people, aren't doing R&D. The main difference to our plan was maybe they should stop using foreign. It would still be the same cost. If you set it at 3%, they are about 3% of value added. The only difference is, please don't go and reinforce the R&D capacity of Europe, or wherever they're doing it, generally Europe. And I'm a cynical old man, and I believe they do that on purpose, because it hedges their bets. They already have their exposure on mining in South Africa. If they do the R&D somewhere else, then, you know, if you've got a pessimistic view of South Africa, then you've put a few eggs in another basket. So there's no extra cost, so I don't see it scaring away investors. On the resource rent tax scaring away investors, well, it doesn't. All of your top economists, like Stiglitz and so on, they all agree this is the most efficient tax, because it only triggers these if you score. If you don't, so there's no downside risk. You're guaranteed a reasonable return, and you won't attract the tax. But if the deposit turns out to be extremely rich, then you share that with the owner of the deposit, which is the people of South Africa. Where does the 50% come from? Well, as I said, for hydrocarbons, it goes up to 90. I've got cases. And for minerals, it goes right down to 20. I don't have a strong justification for 50, other than it is natural justice, that if there is a lack, it should be shared between the operator and the owner equally. But if you want to argue for 60 or 70, one could make an argument. In hydrocarbons, where the resource rents are so high, the average is around 70% resource rent tax. So that's not the issue. We can argue about the level we put it at. The issue is we need to put it. We don't have one at the moment at all. And this, as I said, will not touch marginal mines and average mines. They won't pay it, because it only triggers in once you've made a normal return on investment.
Thank you. As indicated, I'll take over. I've already been introduced. I'm not going to introduce myself. But before I take a round of questions, I'll give to Mr. Baki 2 minutes, just to make additions.
Thank you very much. I think something that comes up, what the gentleman right at the end of the table mentioned, is that we've already got a litany of issues on the table. We know what they are. We've spoken about them. What we tend to talk around is the fact that what Dr. Jordan said, the rats and mice, the people that misbehave. And those are the people that we need to probably spend a little bit more attention on. When you look at the way resources are concentrated in South Africa, you'll find that three companies control 90% of the resources in the PGM space. Three companies owns 90% of the diamonds in South Africa. Four companies owns 90% of the gold in South Africa. If you can get those companies, those few companies, and they're probably on Ms. Adebe's list of 49, if you can get them to behave like good corporate citizens, then you're probably on a winning wicket. What Dr. Jordan mentioned earlier is that we fail to discipline the major culprits. And just like we know the list of the issues that we put out today that stands in the way of beneficiation, we kind of have a good idea of who the major culprits are as well. And we need to take them to task. You know, we can change the world as Mr. Albert mentioned earlier, you know, who's going to come back and invest. But understand that the rats and mice are always going to have the small pieces of the deposits. The BE companies have always come in and taken the last of what was available. It's here where we have this over-concentration of resources in the hands of those few companies that we can actually make an impact. And I think that if we can discipline those major culprits, I think we stand a fighting chance. We know where the gaps are. We know what the loopholes are. We have fancy names for them. We have fancy colloquiums about them. But the point is, we need to get these guys. We need to get these guys to behave like good South African citizens, good corporate citizens. Otherwise, we're going to be doing this for another 20 years. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you. I will now take another round of questions. Honorable Nosina, Deputy Minister.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I think for me, more than a question is it's a matter of a discussion and engagement. We are talking about transformation in imperatives which have not been met. And we are saying that in 2014, May would have been a deadline. For me, the issue is if we want to make progress, is what do we do? So if we start there, we then can begin to craft a message that will go to government or the state or whatever you want to call it, to say from here, this is what we are going to do, because the policy environment is so flexible that we can do certain things as long as there is a general consensus between all the role players. So for me, that's the first thing that we need to do. And we must always ask ourselves, why are we concerned about the economy, state of the economy in South Africa? Why is the ruling party speaking firmly about radical economic transformation? For me, there are two things. It's growth and it's jobs. And we'll need to attend to those issues, because if we don't, I think that we are heading for serious crisis in South Africa, and we'll have to attend to those things. And I think there are a lot of fascinating proposals which we must then say, how do we build them into the broad policy framework in South Africa? If you speak about local content, value addition concept, how do we ensure that those become now a priority of the plans and how we want to position things? There are certain things that should have happened which have not happened. There are certain things that are in the pipeline. So for me, it's striking the balance between those. Maybe let me start with issues of coordination. I think what colleagues are raising here, generally, generally, you see, the issue of coordination has been a major problem in government. And I don't think that we must sit here and lament and complain. We must then say, what are concrete proposals? I know that the economic cluster at the level of the executive is already seized with the matter of coordination, and how can you make sure that you crystallize some of these efforts and make sure that the economic plan is seamless, but also even in terms of how we implement, we begin to appreciate that certain things will happen somewhere. We have raised sharply the issue that, you see, if DTI as a government department must drive industrialization in South Africa, they must have all the instruments at their disposal to do so. And I can tell you that the issue of IDC is very top on the agenda of the thing that we need to speak about. But beyond that, if you speak about issues of infrastructure development and all the other things that we're mentioning here, there are certain reforms that we also need to consider as a point. So those are the things that for me we want us to look at. And then the things that we have not been able to do, or in a much more focused way, there is a state mining company, but I'm not sure whether or not they understand why they were created. And we need to focus in that area to say, look, the state mining company was created for a specific reason. There are new proposals. Whether those new proposals, they come because people are desperate, the state mining company is not responding to the issue, it can be a question point. And the last issue that I wanted to raise because of time is that the approach for me, which I think is what is coming up even from the discussion, is that we need to focus more on regional integration as well as intra-Africa trade to expand our own markets, so that even when we beneficiate some of these minerals, we're able to know where is our markets. And I think that there's a lot that we can still do in terms of developing our own continent. So we have to really come up with very firm proposals on how we're going to do that. And the last issue, there are 10 special economic zones that are on the cards. For me, the discussion around the SEZ should be where are the focus areas and why? And I think we've had some presentations here that are beginning to give us a sense. because while you go to Ghana, where Honorable Mantashe comes from, and put an S, is that if there are no you know, tangible minerals in that area, not that there isn't anything, you might find that you need to do some interventions around agriculture in that specific area, for example. So those are the issues that we need to engage, so that we are able, beyond meetings like this, we are then able to say, here is a concrete proposal, and then we go to respective people who must implement it. We say to them, business as usual, here are the fair proposals, let's align your plan, let's go. Because all these things, having looked into the medium-term strategic framework, we are talking about things that the government is already seized with, but how fast can we do them is what we should be concerned with. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Member. I gave you extra minutes. I'm sure you are aware. Honourable Chair.
Thank you, Chair. I'd just like to start by suggesting that the very word beneficiation seems to have a sort of magical air about it. It's almost as though beneficiation per se just happens magically, and, you know, that just because there is a product available, a raw material input available, necessarily leads to it being exploited or turned into a more value-added product. And I think we have to question that assumption, because it doesn't actually happen like that in the real world. The real world is where business people see an opportunity, and they collect a whole lot of resources together, including labor, capital, inputs, raw materials, intellectual property, and that results in a business. And a business starts with an idea and a demand. And invariably one finds that the raw material input costs are comparatively small total or part of the proportion of the total input costs in a product. So whilst I totally agree that there are demonstrable abuses, and you know, those could include Sasol, those could include the other oil companies, those could include ArcelorMittal, I'm not familiar with the absolute details. I think that the discussion also needs to ask the more fundamental question as to, is the availability of a mineral or a petrochemical input necessarily going to lead to that flowering of new business opportunities? My answer to that is possibly no, and that what we need to do as an economy is to look at the factors that are holding back entrepreneurship and growth of businesses, such as constraints, managed input costs, electricity, transport infrastructure, possibly legislation restrictions which lead to disincentives to invest, and other things, you know, like the appalling problems that we have in education, which Dr. Jordan referred to, the lack of STEM and RDI in this country, which really are back, the creation of added value industries in this country. So those are just a few general comments. More specifically, on the question of transfer pricing, I would be very interested to see more than just, you know, assertion here. I'd like to see some facts and figures. I'd like to see some, you know, follow the money. In other words, let's have a look and see, Mr. Haddadi, where this transfer pricing is taking place. What are these tax havens? Why aren't, you know, countries like the UK, the European Union, America, doing something about this? Because clearly it's not in their interest either. The next thing is, I think the upstream value adding is an area that has been sorely neglected, and I'm very pleased to see Dr. Yudan's presentation included reference and emphasis on that, because in an upstream situation, one already has a market. You know, one has the big mining companies, and the fact that the inputs of these Southern African mining companies is bigger than the European Union is a very important statistic. So I think that we need to try and find ways of encouraging upstreaming as well as downstream. And then finally, I'd just like Ms. Pendevi to maybe give us examples of where her company is already beneficiating. You know, what products are you producing using the minerals that you are actually taking out of the ground? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Member. Honourable Member Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Being a member of the Mining Portfolio Committee, what I have to say might not be that sounds in economic terms, but it basically comes down to the following. Minerals or international commodity. And I do not see enough engagement, in my view, from what I've heard and seen, and maybe in the future, but about comparative studies, about comparative jurisdictions, about what Australia is doing in the international mining community, what Canada is doing, how it's dealing with the matter. Because we need guidelines, we can learn from the different countries. But I think what Mr. Chance has said, I would like to put in the following. From having a comparative advantage of having minerals, it needs to be a competitive advantage. And if you go and look, what factors determine competitive advantage? It is not just the availability of minerals. One major importance is electricity, power. If the cost of power is too high, or there is a lack of power, then there is a limitation on beneficiation, because beneficiation, in my understanding, is value addition. It is electricity intensive. It is not job creative intensive, job creation intensive. Upstream is job creation intensive. So it depends on what the availability are. And I don't see enough, let's put it, honesty in dealing with issues such as why is Comro closed, the Chamber of Mines Research. I've heard Mr. Chortan give an indication, but why? What money normally doesn't have colour. I mean, it follows where you can make profit. Why is Comro closed? Why is research and development contributions dwindling? Those issues we need to honestly deal with, because I think if we honestly deal with it, will we hopefully come to a solution where a blueprint as to how the Department of Trade and Industry, the lead department, should be dealing with this matter.
We do have two mining state mining companies, Alexco and AEMFC. And the Deputy Minister is quite right to ask, what have they done? So we need to honestly deal with these examples, see where the shortfalls are, come back and say, listen, these are the identified issues, these are the pitfalls, how do we deal with them, and then deal with, I've read the Sims report, I don't understand all of it, and I don't agree with all of the recommendations, but at least it's a starting point, it deals with it. And we need to look at issues from a financial perspective, at least beating the same drum. It should be, what's the economic benefits of it, and how do we complement it with BEE affirmative action? Not the other way around, because then we are on a lose-lose path. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Member. Honourable Fox.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. Certainly, we've heard a lot here from yourself, Dr. Jordan, and in particular, one welcome the proposals towards a national sort of strategy, tightening things up here and there. But it looks like it's going to be quite a mammoth task in trying to achieve it. And yet on the other hand, it needn't be. When you look at some of the things here, I was just looking at issues such as simple linkages and tighter coordination. It doesn't take a train smash, it doesn't take money, financial resources. It takes political will here. On the other hand, there's also the private sector, which was referred to by, in particular by yourself, Mr. Barchi, the need for behavioural change here in the value addition upstream people, etc. What I would have liked to have learned, and someone has brought it up, we know about the energy as a major constraint. We know about that. But unless I was focusing on admin and not listening clearly all the time, I never heard too much being said about other constraints, such as transport. I heard the skills being raised, a very critical one, but I didn't hear transport. I didn't hear issues around insurance, per se. I didn't even hear issues around water. And my previous knowledge and matric, etc., it said you need water for manufacturing. But it may have changed. I don't know how the processing is done now. If it's leapfrogged to the moon or something, Chair, let me leave it there and see if we can get some responses. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Member. Are there any further questions? So you are covered. I'm now going to give over to the presenters to respond. I don't know which one is going to start.
Chair, I will start. I'm not going to probably try to answer around the issue of IDC and its location, and also try to be... But what I would like to focus the colloquium on is that we want to understand what are the blockages for value addition. And when we analyze the blockages, one of the blockages that we highlighted, we said it's energy. And you can choose where you want to be in the economy. If you don't have a resource, you are like Korea or Germany, then you look at your development differently, because first you must say, what is it that I have that I can then produce, or what skill do I have to offer to the world? If we were only to leave the energy intensive sectors and say, it has been highlighted here that steel constitutes 70% of what you see. So steel is an important input into the industrial sector or into the tertiary sectors. Now, if we were to import, we can import steel at import parity prices, and we don't have a metal with us. We can import steel because we don't have the iron ore and the manganese and everything that can make us steel. But we have the resources to make steel here. Then what is our problem currently is that we don't have enough energy. But if we choose to import steel, in the meantime we are trying to sort out our energy problem, that is fine. Then we can say, let's then focus on the tertiary sectors. Now, on the tertiary sectors also, you must understand, you have a limited market as an economy. We only have 60 million people or so, and half of them cannot, more than half of them cannot buy. So our market is very tiny to make a difference. So you need scale in this thing. So we need to focus now externally and say, what else can we do if we want to be competitive and industrialized? One of the issues that has been raised is that maybe we have been focused in traditional markets. And because there was no China competing with us on price, we were good to sell into Europe and the Americas. Now China is cheaper than us, and it's competing hard. So where can we go? We have our neighbors here. They also take product from China. So, but if you listen to people who transport goods, it takes a longer time to move products from Johannesburg into Zambia and other countries than it takes for you to move them from China, and it's more expensive. So we need to solve the problem of road, of infrastructure that link us to the other African countries, so that we are able to deliver quickly and cheaper to our neighbors who are our market. And they are growing faster than us. So we have a market, and therefore, and we have raw materials. Currently the raw material price is higher than what we should be getting at. So we need to deal with the price issue. So there is many other things that we are trying to look at, but they also need, I think, the political will is the important weight, that we need to drive hard and be willing. Currently, the charters, all these legislations that are in place are vague. Yes, the minister has the right to do something if he determines that it is necessary. So if he doesn't determine that it is necessary, he won't do it. And you can't say, the minister, you haven't done your job, because he didn't determine that it is necessary. But if we are clear in goals that the minister or the mining charter should determine that 50% of the raw material will be put at X price. If he doesn't enforce that, then we can hold him accountable. But these things are, there's no accountability, they are very vague.
Located. Mechadev.
In terms of the gentleman who asked the direct question to me, then I'm actually quite happy you asked that question. Because I think 2014, which is the charter compliance year, is actually a year where mining companies should stand up in front of the portfolio committee and the people of South Africa to make the exact demonstrate and examples of what you're talking about. Because I would really urge and plead and request that we are asked to come back and make specific demonstrations of what the issues are in those mining companies, bearing in mind that in the issue of beneficiation, for instance, if you're a BE company and you own 9.5% or you own 6.5% or you own not less than, not more than 25%, you find that you can't even market the company, nor can you manage the company. It's done by the non-BEE. And it's in those management and marketing where you have a partner that, of course, the offshore owner. And that offshore owner takes all the money in management fees and marketing fees. And there's no profit declared. And when you tell the offshore owner, we would like to make sure that there is some money to beneficiate, they tell you there's no money. Why is there no money? The very issue of how transfer pricing takes place. But if there was money reflected, there would be money to go and beneficiate. So you find the BE companies are very entrapped. But not only are you entrapped, there's a unique, honorable, broad-based black economic empowerment requirement where all and sundry should also own shares. So you find that even when you, and all and sundry owning shares in good faith. So you find that all of us are going for the crumbs of what is left behind, 26%, where everybody ends up having 2.5% for women, the SOP 5%, and even if you're a technical producer of like Macau Mining, would like to have more, you're not allowed to. Or if you are allowed to, the non-BE is not going to dilute the shares for you. So those are the things that has to be looked into, because as far as the ownership structure is foreign-owned, you are not able to do the changes that you want to do as a South African. Hence, I say, please invite us so that I can come and demonstrate how transfer pricing, we have facts, figures, and we do have ways in which you're going to, the financial people will come and will just, within 10 minutes, exposed by the issues are, and protect us, because we have signed confidentialities. But there's nothing that says if you're called to Parliament, you cannot declare and openly speak, because the law supersedes, hopefully, we'll just look at the legalities behind it. And then we'll demonstrate case by case what is happening out there and where the money goes to, because we know from all these mining houses, we know
few seconds.
And in terms of beneficiation, does it create jobs? I'm going to just ask you just to respond to that. But as I'm saying, conclusion, I think the time has come for us to be not theoretic, but to be demonstrative. And we are ready with the facts, we're ready with all the information to come and demonstrate what it is that we're talking about. Not because of one company, we have a lot of companies. If it's fronting, we have a 500-page research that SAMDA has done. We've paid more than $8 million for this research. We can even unpack many other companies. I was just showing the gentleman from the IDC what he owns in 1 minute and where the IDC is contributing towards transfer pricing by virtue of investing in all these other companies without the
Thank
IDC.
Thank you, Mr. Devin. Mr. Bonake.
Thank you, Chair. In conclusion, on my part, I think what we've said is most of the ingredients for job creation have been identified. I have a list here of sectors that are critical for growth. Steel, plastic, I have forest, they are the subject of discussions in this colloquium. And the interesting thing is we all have them in the country. And often we have them cheaper. We are able to get cheaper than most of our competitors. Now the question is, why are we not competitive in manufacturing, which is going to lead to employment? And it all comes down to the incumbents, what the incumbents have been able to extract and take away from those who could be beneficiating and manufacturing downstream. Now, I do take the challenge from the Deputy Minister that we ought to make proposals about what these interventions should be. We've done that in the past on steel and plastic, but I think that we would be very happy if there is an initiative, in particular around those two, because those two, there was a slide showing what happened to jobs and the sector when prices were favorable to local producers. So we will make those proposals, but when we make those proposals, I must emphasize that the challenge of coordination is not a small one, because some of the interventions will require departments like National Treasury. So it's important that we understand the enormity of the task, that if you're going to talk forestry, you're going to need DPE, which owns much of the forestry interest in the country. But I do welcome the proposal around what us needing to get together and make things specific proposals, and we will certainly take the Deputy Minister up on that.
Thank you, Mr. Bonakelli. Prof. Sam.
Thank you, Chair. I'll just touch on a couple of points. The first one, I think, is whether it makes a difference. And I think, I'm a little bit surprised that we're having this discussion, because most people would agree that, if you don't have competition to discipline the power of companies, just as if you don't have competition disciplining Socrates, you have very poor coaching, very poor management, and high salaries which are not justified. So you need rivalry. You need rivalry to have good quality, whether it's in sport or whether it's in activity. And it doesn't matter who owns the companies. The companies can be owned on a cooperative basis. They can be owned by the state, which is the case in China. But if you don't have this rivalry, then you're not going to have the effort and creativity, the customer service being rewarded. And so that's a kind of a starting premise. I think the second thing about the management of resources and resource rents, there's also been quite a lot of work on this, and there's many different ways in which resource rents can be captured. One is the Spence Growth Commission, which had a broad spectrum of people on it, academics, government leaders from across the world, and it agreed that with resource rents, you have luck, and you must capture those rents, but you mustn't spend them. Like you won the lotto. You don't spend the lotto. You must invest it in education, infrastructure, health, etc. So it's a long-term perspective rather than a short-term perspective. And there's many ways of doing this. A state-owned company means that the state already has the rents. You can do it through taxation. And you're using examples of Norway's Statoil or Petronas in Malaysia, with which Statoil has a joint venture. So they're very well aware of the different mechanisms. What you need to do is you need to make sure those returns are invested and not squandered. The last thing on the region, I think it's really important, this issue of regional integration, because in a wider market you can have more rivalry. And so we should be supporting steel industries in our neighbouring countries, for example, or heavy industries in our neighbouring countries. We should not be thinking that we are going to be just exporting everything. They will not buy from us if they are not also developing their industries. And for that, it's a deep regional integration. It's about a change in our mindset about the region as a whole. And remember, our cartels and monopolies have also extracted rents from all of the consumers in the region. If you're sitting in Havaroni, you have paid the cement cartel margins. And I think we need to understand from that perspective that there's a collective need to address this across the region. Region integration is critical in these issues.
Thank you, Prof. Doctor, you wanted to say something?
Mr. Chance, is it not all minerals have a particular advantage? Of course not. We have most of the vanadium resources in the world, but it's a tiny component into special steels, so we're not going to dominate vanadium steels. But for many minerals, it's very high, and we've heard Dr. Roberts, where it's over 60%. In your Ekurhuleni capital goods sector, it is 30 to 50%. This is significant. That is why what was put forward was not a supply side, because we have some exotic mineral, therefore we must beneficiate, but a demand side. Where are the jobs? And then work backwards. What are the critical minerals? And then it's clear. It's steel, it's polymers, it's base metals, etc. So we need to get those minerals in at the cheapest possible price. Then there was the issue of the transfer pricing. Well, international evidence shows that it's not a matter of BEE or not. It's a matter of domestic capital or foreign capital. Clearly, foreign capital has much more opportunity. They've got branches all over the world. They can do over-invoicing of inputs. They can double the price of the caterpillar because it's coming from a related company. They can also under-invoice. They can hedge to themselves that it's below the world market price, which one company in Zambia is doing. And they hedge into, of course, a tax haven in Switzerland. They have international beneficiation facilities, so what makes sense for them is to take a concentrate from your country and do it somewhere else. These are good business decisions. But that wouldn't happen if you relied on domestic capital, which Europe did. Europe didn't have foreign capital. Finland, until the 90s, didn't allow anyone except Finns to get a prospecting license. So it's more an issue. I'm not saying, therefore, ban foreign investment. I'm just saying, be aware. The scorpion comes with a sting. And if we have the right rules and regulations, we can control it because we need the capital skills, etc. The issue, Mr. Albert, of have we done comparisons? Under the Sims, we visited, I think, 12 countries, and we compared with 30. Your examples of Canada, Australia, if you really see them, yeah, we can do that. We can all commit suicide and be invaded, like they did, and bring the skills in. I mean, they killed all the indigenous people and took enormous resources. It's not a model for us. We look rather at the developmental states, right, where they got involved in the production of these critical feedstocks. It's common to all of them, whether it was Taiwan, Korea, China, Prussia, then Germany, all the Scandinavians, which were developmental. But the plunder state, Australia, which is the plunder state, Canada, is not an example you actually want to follow. It kind of works there just to have an open free-for-all, as we've seen. But I don't think it's an option for us, unless you really think that's an option, to follow their example. Beneficiation not being job-intensive. The first phase isn't. But you've got to go through the valley of death to get the you've got to have the low employment steel plant to get the steel. I agree, the jobs are in downstream steel, they're in fabrication. So not necessarily, and also beneficiation is either hydro or pyro. If it's the hydro route, hydrometallurgy, it's not in energy intensive. If it's a pyro route, smelting, yes it is. Why did Comro go bust? It was early 90s and they just wanted to cut costs. The chamber used to finance it. It was the biggest in the world. And it was also when they got precocious and said, you know, we don't develop technology, and I'm quoting one of our companies, you know, we now buy it. Well, in fact, they don't. They now develop it with other people. So they still have the same cost, but they're just not doing it here anymore. They're doing it elsewhere. The Honourable Member of Parliament, but on transport, I agree with you totally, it is important, but as you beneficiate, it becomes less important, because the higher the value of the product, transport is unit value, the less important. So it's more important for low-value minerals. And the DTI and DPE are looking at having tariffs that are proportionate, inversely proportionate to the value added, i.e. instead of what we do now is we charge more for value added goods that we want and less for bananas like iron ore and coal, to turn that around and to actually charge, send a signal to industry that will charge you less for on tariffs. I think it's an excellent idea, and the National Ports Authority is already looking at tariffs that are inversely proportionate to value added. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Jebe. We have 5 minutes, so I'll take the last question. Honorable Sulam. 2 minutes, please.
Thanks, Chair. I wanted us as a committee to accept the offer from both the Competition Commission and SAMDA to come and give us a comprehensive presentation on transfer pricing and some of the interventions that have to be effected from the Competition Commission side, so that we're able to give directive on some of the actual things that should happen. So I don't think this must be a talk shop process where we just talk and nothing happens concretely moving forward. I think it can help us to take some of the decisions. Also on beneficiation, I mean, some of the things that I heard from behind me, I do not know from who, are quite shocking in terms of the observations on beneficiation. I think it can be able to help us to guide a concrete process on how do we proceed moving forward. So I used 1 minute, Chair. Thanks.
Can we hear from the two presenters? A proposal made, whether you agree to come and make a presentation to the committee.
Give me the date. I've got all the facts and to time. And I'll bring the people and we will expose what's happening. Because that's now as I'm talking, you know. So give us the date, and then what we'll do is with the DMR, we just need protection because we've written confidentialities. And of course, the DMR calls them to account to declare. I mean, you'll have to talk around it and make sure that whoever comes and present won't be sued outside for being for confidentialities that you sign and stuff like that. But that can be attended to. But give me the date and the time, and I'll come with all the details because it's there.
Thank you. Dr. Bonaki.
Thank you, Chair. We're happy to come.
No, thank you very much. We now close, Minister. I'll give you a minute, but I'm left with only 2 minutes close.
No, just 30 seconds. I don't know whether this meeting can guide us, because there was an issue that was raised, which I think is fundamental, was raised on the board that we didn't really entertain that much, and the impact of that board, I think, is very significant. Can we request the chairperson to write to your counterpart at the level of DMR so that we can continue that discussion, because it would appear that we need to activate that board. Thank you.
1 minute, Chairperson.
I'll just need 10 seconds, I think, but thank you, Honourable Chairperson. With respect to the request that's just been put forward, this is the whole thing that we want concrete proposals here. Mm-hmm. We are going to substitute, if it suits the stakeholders, Wednesday the 3rd, what is already on that program there, we will bring in yourselves. That's next Wednesday. Next Wednesday, we will also pursue what the Minister, the Deputy Minister, has just put forward to us here and try and tackle that. Thank you.
Competition Commission also. Chair. Person, there was also a request that the DCC must also come.
Certainly, Chair, you know, the relevant people, I think it was also Dr. Jordan, I mean, you know, the relevant stakeholders that we do require, all others would be welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. That concludes the discussion. I'm now going to hand over to Honorable Mkonji to do concluding remarks.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. The stakeholders are also invited tomorrow If you can come and assist also in the discussion, if we have time. So the chairperson is requesting that you also come to Mona. The matter that we are discussing this morning and you want to conclude as time goes, especially in this fifth term of Parliament, is to deal decisively with the over-concentration of resources to the minority. That is the task that this committee is having, to make sure that we deal decisively with over-concentration of resources to the minority at the expense of the majority of our people. So the key issues or instruments that are going to assist us to succeed is for our state to intervene actively in the economy of the country. So the issue of developmental state should not be a theory or a theoretical issue. It should be a practical issue where a state is actively transforming the economy. So one of the instruments is industrialization and beneficiation. I know we are running away. We are running away because there is an issue of ideologizing this debate and disguising behind the issues. One of the ideological contestations is whether we follow the downstream or the upstream. It is ideological because if we sit at the upstream, we are sitting on the over-concentrated resource benefit to the few. That is what the debate shows. So we must be clear that why we want the downstream beneficiation process is because it will benefit the majority of our people. And the upstream is going to be concentrated into the same owners of the industry. Because we do this because our aim is to make sure that there is economic growth, a faster economic growth in South Africa with job creation. So some of the economists, they talk about the question of the demand side of this particular economy. So now, the matter that makes us not to be able to transform decisively this economy is a broad daylight robbery that is taking place. And as government and legislator, we need to deal with that broad daylight robbery that is taking place in the form of import parity pricing and lack of competition discipline, because there is no discipline in South Africa. That is why we find this import parity pricing, broad daylight robbery, because people are ill-disciplined. And we need to deal with that thing. One of the things that the stakeholders are calling for us to intensify local mining. We must tighten the rules, the playing field, and the regulation. We need to discount them and incentivize them. There is a call for the alignment of the charter with the BBEE codes and the resuscitation of the task of the state-owned mineral mine company. There are clear proposals if we wanted a coordinated system. One is to call for cabinet to establish an interministerial committee on industrialization and beneficiation in South Africa. That is going to lead this process. Because we said that the departments and ministries are operating in silos. So one of the things, the establishment of the interministerial committee on beneficiation, followed by the establishment of the Interdepartmental Committee on Industrialization and the Beneficiation
and also an inter-parliamentary committee, an inter-parliamentary committee on beneficiation and industrialization, because if it does not begin here in Parliament, it's going to be difficult for it to go there. We must enforce compliance with heavy penalties. We must deal with the regulatory failures and shocks, strengthen the capacity of the state. We must strengthen the capacity and the capabilities of the state. Not only the capacity of the state to enforce beneficiation and industrialization. Other proposals are very clear. Are very clear because that inter-ministerial committee is going to discuss the matter of the IDC. It should discuss the matter of the IDC and its location. And the inter-parliamentary committees must also discuss that and make a clear proposal. One of the fundamental proposals that I want to close my closing remarks is the question of the resource rents model. The resource rents model, which should be tailored, you know, should have a tailored offset systems. The possibility, so this is going to talk to the rules and regulations that we want it to be here. We said we must invite you, so you are already invited. Yeah, no. I think that is my only closing remarks that I have, even if they do not give maybe any direction. Thank you very much.
Yes, the meeting is adjourned until tomorrow. We were hoping that we'd try and get here at 8:45 in case there is a technical glitch, just to make sure we do start at 9:00.